was a new man, and I saw it work for him. The only way I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous could take an impossible situation and make it right was when I worked with a man who was involved in an impossible situation, and I saw it get better. I remember the first man I ever sponsored was a man named Alan. Alan's still sober and very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alan called AA because he had a shotgun in his mouth, and his father had committed suicide. He was also an alcoholic and also a successful attorney. And he put a gun in his mouth and blew his brains out. And Alan had a gun in his mouth, and he had tried it many times to make sure he could reach the trigger and everything. And there's something about the message in Alcoholics Anonymous Alan stayed sober for about a month, and one day we're headed to a meeting, and we'd taken the shotgun that Alan had and just threw it in my trunk, and I didn't think anything about it, you know, and so about a month later I'm taking Alan to a meeting, and Alan said, you know, I don't think I'm going to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, why is that? He said, what happens? He said, like if my daughter gets married and they have champagne and they toast a bride. And I said, Alan, you don't have a daughter. He said, I know, but I might. So we're in one of those circles, you know, those crazy circles in Washington, you know? And I just stopped, you know, and cars are going around me. And I went around and I unlocked a trunk and I brought the shotgun around and I showed Alan. And where his mouth was, it was all red with rust. And Alan said, oh, yes, now I remember. And I put the shotgun back, and he didn't drop out of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an amazing thing now. Now, you know, we're dealing with an illness that would take a very bright man like Alan and make something like that make sense to him, you know, that he should drop out of AA so that he could toast his daughter in case he ever had one. And I was lucky when I got sober because I fell in with a group of people who were immediately active, and they took me with them. I was immediately active. They took me the very first thing. I was sober maybe 5 weeks, and they took me to the Howard Pavilion, St. Elizabeth's Hospital, and that's the place for the criminally insane. And I said, well, what is it you want me to do? And they said, bring cigarettes. Bring cigarettes. You're going to have the cigarette message. And so I'd take cigarettes, and these guys would come to meetings to get a cigarette, and I was the cigarette message. But I watched what happened, and I watched what you people did. Not just how you treated me. I was very interested in how you treated me, but I think in the long run I was more interested in how you treated other people. And I remember the first official 12-step call I went on. Dan called me up, and if you're kind of new, this was my experience, and I think the lesson in this experience is simply that you can't do it wrong if you stay sober. But Dan called me up and said, we have a 12-step call to D.C. jail, and I was all excited. He said, you want to drive? I said, yeah, I'll drive. And so I went over, and I picked him up, and we drove down to the D.C. jail, and I had the book, you know, so we go into the jail and we sign in and everything. The D.C. jail, this was the old jail, it was a terrible place. The new jail was not a deal, but the old jail was a terrible place. And we went in and they had long lines of windows with little partitions, you know, and you sit in there and you talk on a phone to somebody who's on the other side of this yellow glass about a foot thick. So Dan's on the phone with this guy, and this guy's got these wrinkled blue clothes on and everything, and he's on the phone talking to Dan, and I couldn't hear a thing the guy was saying, but Dan's talking to him. He's telling about Alcoholics Anonymous. He's telling him his story and this and that and everything. Dan's very calm. He's a real calm guy, and he's calmly answering this guy and everything. And so Dan said at the very end, he said, look, he said, we only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to let you meet a friend of mine. He said, his name's Keith, and he's been with us about 3 months now, and he's really doing well, and I'm going to let him talk to you for a couple minutes. I'm thinking, a couple minutes? I mean, I need more in a couple minutes. I mean, I got a lot to say to this guy. So I grabbed the phone and I began to preach to this guy. And I began to tell him what he needed to do and all the rest of it. And finally he said, wait a minute, buddy, wait a minute. He said, all this AA crap's fine for a guy, loser like you. He said, but I'm a Fulbright scholar. And I just lost it. And I began to scream, well, Mr. Fulbright scholar, one of us is leaving here in a few minutes. The other one's going to go back to his cell in his wrinkled up blue uniform. And and Dan was trying to get the phone away from me. And and I wasn't finished. And I was down on my knees screaming at this phone about at this guy and everything. And it seems that the other guests were peeking around our thing to see what was going on. And then finally the guards came to see what was going on. And Dan got the phone away from the guy, and Dan said, "Look, I'll come back and talk to you some more tomorrow." "Okay, I'll come alone." And he hung up, and we left. And I knew I was going to be drummed out of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we walked across the street to the parking lot, and I just couldn't stand it anymore. And finally I stopped, and I said, "That was pretty bad, wasn't it, Dan?" And he said, "Well, you know, Keith," he said, "most guys wouldn't have done it that way." He said, "But you're going to discover that we all develop our own technique in Alcoholics Anonymous." And the last I ever heard of it, you know, thank God, it's the last I ever heard of it. But I was fortunate because very early on I got involved in this thing of carrying the message. And what I had said earlier about not accumulating, I think, is very, very important. And, you know, if you have a little, take that little and give it away. And then when you go back, there'll be more. And then you can take that and give it away. But if you wait till you have enough, you never will. Think back to the people that made a difference in my life. And they weren't the people who necessarily said the clever things, though I knew a lot of those. There was a man named Dick L., who's still very active in Alcoholics Anonymous in Washington, D.C. And I went to a meeting, and Dick introduced himself to me. And the next week, I went back to that meeting, and Dick met me. After I came in the door and he walked over, he said, "Well, Keith, how are you?" And he remembered my name. I can't tell you what that did to me, that somebody remembered my name. And he shook my hand firmly and he said, "Why don't you come with me? I want you to meet some friends of mine." And he took me over and he introduced me to Bill and to Art and to Dan, who was later to be my sponsor, and to a couple other people who were there. And he introduced me as his friend. And then he went on and he told these people a little bit about me. He said, "Keith's been sober, what is it? I guess about 6 weeks now, huh?" And he said, "You know, he was in the treatment center and he's been out now a couple of weeks and he works at such and such a place." And he told him things about me that he remembered when he'd asked me the week before. And there's no way I can express to you what that did to me. Somebody who was eminently forgettable in his own mind, and a guy who he had just met for a few minutes would remember his name and a few things about him. And he carried the message in as powerful a way as it's ever been carried to me. And that's something we can all do. We can all pay attention to the new guy. And the new guy is the guy who has a day less than us. I believe that as we go through, I believe that at different times in our sobriety, we're good at different things. I personally believe that the best 12-steppers on 12-step calls are people who are sober 2, 3, 4, 5 years. I really believe that. There's an enthusiasm that's usually born out of necessity that causes people to be rabid in their 12-step work. And I love to go with these people. One of the deals I try to do is people always say, "Nobody goes on 12-step calls anymore." Well, if you want to go on 12-step calls, there are a lot of them. You just have to ask for them or find them. And I like to go with pretty new people in the program, first 5 years in the program, to just maybe be some support to them. But they do the work. I'm a driver. I drive. And I pay for pie and coffee. But my job is basically to drive and then to tell them what a nice job they did, regardless of the outcome, because we don't worry much about the outcome. I also like to encourage people who are sober a little while to do other things. I remember we opened an intergroup office in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and people were running around whining because nobody would volunteer to answer the phones. And I said to the guy, I said, "You know, I answered the phones the first 3 years I was sober in D.C., and the way it happened was my sponsor's sponsor, and he answered the phones. And one day Matt said to Dan, 'Look, do you think Keith's ready to help you?' And Dan said, 'Yeah.' And he said, 'All right, you and Keith take the phones.' So for the next year and a half, Dan and I answered the phones. And then Dan said to me, "You think Alan's ready to answer the phones?" And I said, "I believe he is." And so he said, "All right, so..." And then on and on and on and on. And a guy told me when I was up there recently that that's an unbroken chain now, 25, 26 years, answering the phones at that time slot. And yet they expect somehow that a drunk is supposed to know how to answer a phone and talk to other drunks, and they'd never done it. And that one of the characteristics of drunks is we're not going to ask. You know, we'll say no rather than say we don't know how to do that. You know, I have a friend, Bo T. You may know him. He's a great Al-Anon speaker, and I know Bo, and I saw this happen. He tells his story, and I know this is true because I saw it happen. Bo works at a halfway house, and he'll pull his car or his truck into a halfway house, you know, and he'll just open the hood and stand there and look at the motor. And pretty soon the drunks start coming out of the house. Nobody says a word. Pretty soon they're looking at it. And then pretty soon they're telling him what's wrong with the motor. There's nothing wrong with a motor. But if you open a hood and let a drunk look at it long enough, they'll become experts. Now, you can't take people like that and expect them to admit they don't know how to do things. So those of us who have been around for a while, why don't we teach them? So what I try to do now is anything I do, I try never to do it alone. I try always to have a person around who's a year or so, two, three, something like that, sober. And then they'll learn how to do it, and then they'll take someone, and then they'll teach someone. You know, the principle of the 12th step is that we pass on what we have, not what we don't have. I watched you people very, very closely. I listened to what you said, and then I watched to see what you did. And I've never seen a more consistent group of people in my life. I remember my sponsor when he ordered me to begin answering the phones with him at Monday night. Now, I wasn't permitted to answer the phone. I was, however, permitted to get him coffee. And I used to get him coffee, and I'd pace back and forth and obsess about me. You know, one of these, enough about me, what do you think of my shirt deals? And I was pacing back and forth, when I got sober, my teeth were in just terrible shape. I mean, my gums bled all the time and all this stuff. And so I'm pacing back and forth, obsessing about this and everything. And I stopped and I looked at Dan. And Dan was talking to a woman on the phone who was drunk. And she was inviting him to come over to her house. And Dan was explaining to her that we don't do it that way in Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "What I will do, though, is I will call a couple of women and they can come over." And then he said, "No, ma'am, I don't think you're a lesbian. No. These women will be coming over to tell you about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous." And he was so kind and so gentle and so loving. And a reality slammed home to me that night. I'll never forget. I just looked at him. And I had to excuse myself because I was moved to tears. I went into the bathroom. Here's a man who's doing something nice for somebody, and she'll never know who he is. And I didn't understand until that very moment the concept of anonymity. I thought that there's only so much credit in the world. And if I don't get mine, then somebody else will get it. And it may not make sense to you, but that's really the way I thought it was. You know, there was only so much bologna, and if I didn't get to the table first, one of my brothers would eat my sandwich. You can stake your life on it. And I thought that's the way it was with life. I thought there was only so much, and you had to grab yours, and you had to run with it. And I realized that night that love is anonymous, and that when those people made Bill Wilson adhere to the principle of anonymity, that they delivered to us the greatest gift we could ever receive, the principle of anonymity, that this man would love this woman enough to care about her, and she would never know who he was. And it just amazed me. And the thing that was amazing about it was when he was done, he hung up the phone and waited for the next phone call. I just couldn't believe it. You know, when we think back to the 12th step and 12th step calls, I have to always talk about one man, and that was a man named Buck Doyle. Buck's not with us anymore, but Buck's sober a long time, and he 12-stepped more people than you can imagine. And Buck always, one of Buck's great gifts was that he could laugh at himself. I never met a person to this day who thought he was as amusing as Buck thought he was. I mean, He said to me one day, we're having lunch. We used to have lunch once a week for a few years. I'd have lunch with him down at Chadwick's, and we'd get roast beef sandwich. Same thing. They just bring it. They knew what we wanted. And Buck said to me one day, he says, I'm never going to get any better, Lewis. He always called people by their last name. He says, you know, Lewis, I'm never going to get any better. And I said, what do you mean, Buck? He said, well, I said, this morning I went running. And he said, you know, I live in an apartment building now. And he said, we live on the second floor. And he said, the guy who lives on the first floor had polio when he was a kid. He says, you know, he said, he's got those braces they wear, and then he's got those canes. And he said, he came walking out. And he said, I've been running. He said, I ran 6 miles. He said, I'm 62 years old. He said, to run 6 miles is really something. I said, what? It really is. And he said, but you know, this man came by, and he's like this. And he said to me, oh, you've been running, huh, Buck? And I said, yeah. And he said, how far did you run? He said, I told him 7 miles. He said, what I do is never good enough. He said, here's a man who can't run 10 feet. He said, 6 miles would have impressed him. He said, but I always have to bring more. And that's the kind of guy Buck was. And so Buck told me, and I'll get on with the rest of this, but Buck told me his 12-step story. This is my favorite 12-step story ever. Buck was called on a call to Calorama Street. And I was at a club, and he came to the club right after this happened, and he was laughing. Of course, he's always laughing. And came into the club, and he said, man, he said, I just had an experience I wouldn't believe. I said, what's that, Buck? He said, so I got a call. He said, I couldn't find anybody. He said, I called you, Lewis. You weren't home. I said, I was here, Buck. And he said, yeah. And he said, I go on his 12-step call. And he said, it was in Calorama Street. And that's where I hit bottom. So I got to tell you, that's a bad place. And he said, I went up this three-story walk-up. And he said, you know, you smell like urine. He said, it's a terrible place. He said, I knocked on the door. He said, this woman answered the door. He said, she was filthy. He said, she had a dress that was all torn and everything. And had pins in it and everything. It was awful. So I went in there. He said, there were three little kids. He said, they're filthy, Keith. They're filthy. He said, they had diapers were full of stuff and everything. And he said, they were dirty and everything. And then he said, I'm from AA. And the woman says, he's in there. So I went in this room. And he said, there's a man sitting on a bare mattress on the floor with a telephone. And I said to him, he said, there's nothing to sit on. So I sat on the floor and leaned against the wall. And he said, I told him, my name's Buck Doyle. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm here to do a 12-step call. I do a 12-step call, I talk and you listen. And I'm going to tell you my story, and I want you to pay attention because there may be a test. So he shared his story with this guy, and he said, the guy said to him, he went over, he said, well, you know, but that's good for you and everything, but I'm not sure I'm an alcoholic. Buck said, I lost it. He said, I don't do this often, you know that, right, Lewis? I said, you're right, Buck. He said, well, I lost it. He said, I said to the guy, you're not an alcoholic. He said, look at this place, it's a pigsty. He said, those poor little kids running around in there are dirty. They need clothes and things. And he said, that poor woman, she needs clothes. She's got a dress on, it's all torn and everything, and she's dirty. Did you say you're not an alcoholic? And this woman stuck her head in the room and said, excuse me, mister, I don't know who he is. He just asked to use my phone. So I said, what'd you do, Buck? He said, well, I got the hell out of there. What do you think I did? You know, we talk about practicing these principles in all of our affairs, and I think that's the key to the whole thing. I mean, I think the only final examination that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is how we die, if we're sober when we die, and how we live our life before we die. And the proof that this program works is whether or not I can practice these principles in all my affairs. And I think that's such a key to this. And I have to tell you a story. I think frequently we have to go outside of our fellowship to find out who we are and what we are. And I'm reminded a number of years ago, Dumdenny came to, I invited him to play in my member yes golf tournament. And he came to North Carolina, and the week, he came about 10 days early. And so the weekend before our golf tournament, there was an AA golf tournament. We used to have them over in Pinehurst. Every month we'd have a day of golf, and then every 6 months we'd have a two-day tournament and have, you know, 200-300 men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I invited Denny, and he went over, and we played the AA tournament. We came back and played our member guests, and then the next year I called him up and said, would you like to come and play my member guest golf tournament? He said, I'd love to. He said, they're going to have the AA tournament. And I said, well, I said, I don't know, I can check. He said, that's the most fun I ever had. I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, Keith, he said, it doesn't matter with you people, whether it rains or it doesn't rain. He said, nothing matters. He said, you people get together, you have a ball. He said, we met two people on the first tee. He said, you never saw these people before your life. And by the fourth hole, you're cursing each other. He said, you presume a love that I don't have with people I've known for 20 years. And I think what he's talking about are the fruits. Talking about the fruits. You know, our ability to laugh at where we've been and our ability to love each other because of who we are and what we've become. When I was this man Dick L told me one time, he was he's a great writer. He's written a number of plays and that sort of thing. But at this time, he was doing research writing at the National Institute of Health, and so he would always be running across to articles, and he'd always bring me these articles. And he brought me an article that was written by a sociologist who observed us, and she observed the way we do things and on and on and. And she did this for her doctoral dissertation, and she wrote it up, and then she, from her dissertation, she wrote an article for this sociology journal, or social work journal, and I don't remember much of it, but she talked about the tenderness and the love that we have for one another, and she talked about if every organization or institution was designed to help. Could transmit to the person who walked in the door the love that's transmitted from one alcoholic to another alcoholic, then our ability to get better would be greatly enhanced. And she said something, I want to paraphrase this because I've forgotten the quote. She said, they come back night after night to celebrate, or to at least they forget who they were and to celebrate who they've become. And that, I think, is as good a description of Alcoholics Anonymous as any as I've ever heard. We come back night after night. At least we forget who we were and to celebrate what we have become. Just as Dan said, you know, the man I was will drink again. You know, the people we were will drink again. And we can't take this, I'm convinced, and not expand it. We can't take this. Alcoholics Anonymous really is not a selfish program. Alcoholics Anonymous asks me, and it demands of me, that I take what I have and use it elsewhere, and not just in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I practice it, and I think that's where we perfect our arts, but it has got to go outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. I often hear people say that the hardest place to take this is into the home. To deal with children and to do this and to do that. And I've been extremely blessed. When I was out to lunch, my children had a mother and a stepfather who loved them very much and did a very, very fine job of raising them. By the grace of God, I've been included in that in a small way, but more that now that they're adults, I seem to be a better father to adult children than I was to little children. We're buddies now, and they call me and ask me questions and things, and they always say things like, Daddy, what would your friend say about this? And then they'll tell me a situation. They would want to know what you would say about it. And the thing that strikes me, we were coming to Florida one time. We were going to the Bradenton area for a vacation. And the kids were like, I guess, 12 or 13 or something like that. And they used to play this game in the car. And the game was, one of the things I like about you is. And they were doing that, you know, they were enduring their civil rivalry days, so they'd say things like, one of the things I like about you is one day you'll die, to each other. But what do you want Santa Claus to say? And, you know, but then they said, let's do it for a minute. And Kelly said, like about you, is that you're always the same, no matter what I do. She's so insane and do horrible things. And what she likes most about me now is that I'm always the same. How can this happen? How can this happen? You know, I asked one time, how do you treat people that you're close to? How do I treat my brothers and sisters? How do I treat my parents? I mean, how do I keep from getting angry with them? And a guy told me, he says, you know, it's the expectations you have of them. You know, they're not what you wanted them to be, and they're never going to be. And I said, how do I overcome that? And he said, treat them like they're newcomers in Alcoholics Anonymous. So from that time on, I went to treat them like they're newcomers. And this father of mine, who was so practical, he couldn't understand any of the nuances that we pick up on here all the time. I went to see him, and I remember one time we're sitting down there, and he's sitting in a rocking chair rocking, smoking his pipe. And he said, you know, the problem's computers. What do you mean, Dad? He said, computers. He said, it's very simple. He said, anybody who will look can see the problem's computers. And in the old days, I said, what the hell are you talking about, computer? And he said, for example, he said, we had two guys. He said, when I first worked at the pipe coupling, and they made these pipe couplings, you know, oddly enough, and he said, people would call, and they'd say, we need 5,000 3/16 inch or 5/16 inch couplings. And he said, you could call the warehouse. And two guys worked in a warehouse. Believe it or not, their names were Bert and Ernie. It's really a true story. You know? And he said, they'd know if you had them. He said, they got computers down there. And he said, all of a sudden, they don't have two people in the warehouse. They have 10. And he said, and somebody punches the wrong hole in the wrong card, and we don't know how many couplings we have anymore. And then you have to close down the whole line, and you have to retool, and you have to start it up again to make these 5,000 couplings that somebody needs. He said, yep, the problem's computers. And I found myself looking at him, and I said, you know, Dad, I never looked at it that way before. You know, because it doesn't matter who's right. What matters is that I honor my parents. And you taught me to do that. You demanded that I do that. And the way you honor your parents isn't to correct them. My father's done very well with life. If I could do half as well, I would be pleased. We honor them. And honoring our parents, of course, is the commandment that gives us promise. And the promise is interesting, I think. The promise is long life. And I don't think that necessarily means living a long time. Because I know people who live a long time and don't have long life. I think it means that there won't be any problems between me and my parents. And if I practice the principles in all my affairs, there won't be problems between me and my children. All of that will get fixed. And that's a long, long life between my parents and my children. It's a long, long life. If I practice these principles in all my affairs, I can live in a world where I cease fighting everything. What an amazing phenomenon to live in a world where I cease fighting everything. Where I can live with a woman who's permitted to have her opinions and I'm permitted to have my opinions. My wife's a classic example of how to live your life on all the principles. I've never heard her say anything bad about somebody. And I try to bait her into it all the time. I'll say, what do you think of so-and-so? Boy, there's a jerk, isn't it? And she'd say, well, I don't understand why he does some of the things he does. I said, in other words, jerk. And she'll say, well, he's a mystery. And I'll say, well, he's a mysterious jerk. Can't let it go, but she'll never do that. It just it seems to be natural. She works her Al-Anon program, and it just seems to be natural. And I remember one time I got angry at somebody, and I said, why does that guy keep doing that? He does it over and over again. Why does he keep doing it? And she said, I suppose he isn't finished yet. I said, would you let me know when he's finished? I'm tired of watching. She said, I'd be glad to. But there are examples around me all the time of people who practice these principles in all their affairs. I don't want to get political about this. I mean, I got to tell you, you know, a couple of weeks ago when we lost Mother Teresa, we lost someone who I've watched for a long time who practices these principles in all her affairs. I mean, my goodness, she wins a Nobel Prize and she asks them not to have a banquet, but to take the food they would have spent and use it to banquet and give it to the poor. So the examples are there all the time. And what I've done in attempting to practice these principles in all my affairs is that I've got heroes. And I've got a number of heroes, and many of them don't even know they're heroes. But they're my heroes, and I watch them, and I try to emulate them. A guy told me a long time ago that the reason saints are so valuable is saints have led lives that we can emulate. And I think that's true, and I love saints.
But I also love the people that I've chosen to be my living saints, and I emulate the way they do things. You know, I watch some people and the way they treat new people, and some people are magic with new people. I watch the way they treat their children. I saw a guy pick his son up and hug him. The son had just done something, and he picked him up and hugged him and said, you know, you're going to have to be punished for what you did, but I want you to know first how very much I love you. And then he wouldn't let him watch TV for 3 days or whatever the punishment was. And I thought, I'd like to parent like that, and maybe I'll grandparent like that. The way I would have done it was first to get angry and then tell him I loved him. Well, if I did that, maybe they wouldn't understand the reason for the anger. I thought back to my daughter Kimberly, who has always been a great example to me about how to live my life. And I watched Kimberly. She was very slow developing physically because of her problems at birth that I told you about. And Kelly was just the opposite. Kelly was ambidextrous. She could throw right-handed and left-handed. She could do all these things. And we were down in the park, and I was sober probably 6 months or a year, and we're down in the park, and Kelly was picking up stones and throwing them in the stream, and Kimmy was watching her. And Kimmy went over and picked up a stone and tried to throw it, and it went straight up in the air and came down and hit her on the head. And then she looked at things, and she'd think it over, and she'd get this look on her face, and she picked up a stone and threw it again, and it came down and hit her on the head. So she thought about it a little bit. Then she put her other hand on her head and threw the stone, and didn't hit her on the head. And then she threw another one, she threw another one. And finally, she threw one that somehow got stuck in her fingers or something, and it flew way out into the stream, and it splashed. And she turned around and screamed, "Daddy, I did it. Did you see me? I did it." And I said, "That's what I want to do. Because my tendency is if I fail, I stop. And I want to do it until one day I can turn around and say, I did it. You see me? I did it." And there are just many of these. And I won't bore you with all these examples of the people in my life who have shown me how to live life based upon spiritual principles and how to carry these principles into all of our affairs. Let me finish with one more. There's a man whose name I don't know, and much to my chagrin, I should know his name, but when I was newly sober, he was a man who was one of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous in Washington, D.C. And my sponsor told me that this man was dying, and I said, "Well, everybody's got to go sometime." And I was just a bundle of compassion. And my thoughts, better him than me, and at least he'll get to drink wherever he's going, or, you know, whatever my thoughts were. I don't know what they were, but he told me he wanted me to go spend some time with this man. And I said, "Well, I'm really not interested in spending time with someone who's dying. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, what good is that? Hell, what good could he ever do me when he's dead? I mean, he couldn't help me get a job or anything. He's gone." And but I went because Dan would threaten to break my knees all the time. And so we went over, and I spent 3 hours with this man, and it's 3 hours I'll never forget. And it wasn't because of what happened then, because I don't remember most of what he told me. I didn't remember most of anything at that time in my life. But what I realized when I was driving home was, and I said to Dan, I said, "Dan, we talked for 3 hours, and we only talked about him for 5 minutes." And Dan said, "Well, that's because you were more important to him." I said, "He doesn't know me." He said, "Of course he knows you." I said, "You're a new member of Alcoholics Anonymous." He said, "He's done his. His reward is imminent." He said, "You're the guy who needs it, because you're the new guy." And I thought, where do these people learn these things? Where do these people learn to live like this? And I didn't know the answers in the book. The answers are 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My goal in my prayer every day is that I practice these principles in all my affairs in such a way that makes my God proud of what I've done today. If I can do that, I'm indeed a successful and wealthy man. I want to thank you from the very bottom of my heart for your kindness to me this weekend and your attention and everything. You have changed my life in a very real and meaningful way. This is part of the mosaic that happens, and I will remember you forever. I ask that you keep me in your prayers. What I've done this past week when I've gone to Mass or prayed and fasted is I've kept you in my prayers. And I ask that you do the same for me this following week. Thank you very much.